I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Demetra Kasimis, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago. We're discussing her 2018 book, The Perpetual Immigrant and the Limits of Athenian Democracy, from Cambridge University Press. Kasimis works on ancient political thought and contemporary democratic theory, particularly on the themes of membership, exclusion, and immigration. She is the author of several articles on Plato and Greek tragedy. So first of all, let me say, Demi, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So I love the book. It was a great read. I love reading about ancient political theory, and the particular interdisciplinary take that you have on it is great. It's a very timely book, even though it's about the ancients. It's about immigration. And so I appreciated that. So thank you for the book. Let me ask you first. I always ask authors about what motivated them to write the book they did. So what drew you to these texts and to this topic?
I have kind of different versions of my motivation. Some are more personal than others. I mean, I have the kind of almost like the academic or intellectual or disciplinary explanation that I think I kind of discovered almost after the fact or as I was writing. But what drew me initially to it, I can tell you the story of when I was in graduate school in a seminar on Plato's Republic at Northwestern, where I did my PhD. Sarah Monison was putting on the board all the characters in the Republic, and she named Polemarchus and Cephalus as metics. And the word metic, which I say a little bit about in the preface to the book, was a word I actually knew from my childhood. I grew up speaking modern Greek with my father, who is from Greece, and I knew the word metikos from a song that he used to play for me. And I was struck in the class by the fact that I hadn't heard this come up in an ancient Greek context before. So I didn't study classics as an undergrad. I did philosophy and comp lit, and was very interested in contemporary politics, but was kind of good at ancient Greek philosophy. And in philosophy classes, we didn't really contextualize the text. We didn't talk about who the characters were. We kind of transcended the setting, especially the Republic, which of course would go on to be this thing that I became very preoccupied by. So in the classroom, I was really interested I'd always been interested in immigration, but I was also really interested in what I perceived to be a kind of turning away from or lack of interest in this particular category of membership that Plato was putting front and center for us. I was sort of puzzled by it and wanted to learn more.
Yeah, that's great. Let's start with that notion of the metic, which is the central theme to the book. So maybe you could sort of set the context for us, because this is a category, at least in America, we don't have explicitly, although in the right. conclusion, you sort of connect it to some American political current. So I'd be interested in talking about that later. But but let's talk about the ancient Greek notion of a metic. What is a metic?
So a metic is a term, or a metoikos is at some point in the fifth century. It's very difficult to know when, like in the first half of the fifth century, Athenians or the Athenian democracy develops a legal category, a legal distinction of the metic or the immigrant, even though metics and migrants, of course, you know, were in existence way before this category came into existence. You know, there's obviously mobility in the Mediterranean forever. There's this moment in probably after the Persian Wars, when there's like an increase in migration to Athens, where the Athenians decide to regulate immigration. And so the metic becomes a designation for not only immigrants who are going to reside for, say, more than a month in Athens, but also their native-born children. In other words, people who were born in Athens to non-Athenians. And so you mentioned that it's very difficult to find an exact parallel in contemporary politics or discourse, and that is because I can talk about this later, it bridges, it combines two two things that we tend to think of as distinct, right? Somebody who is a migrant to a place, someone who's a foreigner, and the children of foreigners. So then things get a little bit more complicated around the time of around 451, 450, when Pericles' citizenship law is passed, and Athenian citizenship starts to depend on having two Athenian parents. So people are medics if they only have one Athenian parent. And so you can think about how kind of that actually started to not only did it make citizenship more difficult to attain, but it also disenfranchised a whole population of people who would have been eligible for it in an earlier point in Athenian history.
So do I have it right that, so if someone migrated to Athens,
yeah,
they were a medic,
right?
But if they married an Athenian citizen pre-Pericles, then their kids could be Athenian citizens. But then after Pericles came on, he sort of upped the requirement for citizenship.
Right. And you know, there's a possibility that this law relaxed at different points, especially during the Peloponnesian War, when there might have been, fewer male citizens. But overall, yeah, at least juridically, that's the story. And, the thing that's important to remember about medics, and this is something I try to bring out in the book, is that medics were free. So unlike unlike slaves, obviously, who of course in the ancient Greek context, or at least the Athenian context, this was debt bondage. So they could, even slaves could eventually become medics. They could gain their freedom if they paid off their debts. But so it's important to see that slaves were necessarily foreign, right? But not all foreigners were slaves. You could be free, like, of course, the characters in the Republic, Cephalus and Polemarchus, and amass great wealth. They were actually some of the wealthiest people in Attica. And that also meant that there were a number of obligations on medics and privileges. They didn't have, of course, all the privileges of citizenship, but they had some, and that put them in very close proximity to citizens.
I, probably like many, have this idealized conception of Athens versus Sparta, which is in part developed from Pericles himself, that, you know, Athens is, as you say, sort of open cosmopolitan place, and Sparta is this close-minded place. But you bring out the ways in which, you know, the apparently sort of open character of Athens masks the sort of exclusivity of this category of the medics. So I found that useful. I mean, on that transition from in Pericles, is there? I mean, just as a sort of final question to set the context. What is it that drove the Periclean sort of revision of these laws to make it more difficult to achieve citizenship? Was it the obvious thing, I guess, would be the Peloponnesian War, that, the worries about civic trust, I guess that's associated during wartime, that it would make, membership a little bit more difficult to achieve. Was that it? Or did the revisions predate the war?
The Peloponnesian War. Yeah, they predated the Peloponnesian War by about two decades. So if we put the start of the Peloponnesian War around 431, 20 years earlier in 451, as Pericles' citizenship law. You know, there isn't really scholarly consensus on why, the reasons for, although most of the scholarship on the law, on the citizenship shift has focused on trying to figure out the reasons. And my interest was less in, I sort of say this in the first chapter, is less in trying to figure out why, but in looking at the effects of it. And so one possibility was that, you know, there was this increased migration, and formerly, let's say way back under Solon, you know, if you had a trade and you had a family and you were an immigrant, you could be naturalized. There wasn't this sort of in between status for resident foreigners. And so what shifts is, you know, is the shift away from naturalization, which becomes extremely difficult and kind of honorary, an honorary status, you know, almost for people who wouldn't use it or wouldn't really need it. You know, we can think about contemporary analogs to that today, you know, wealthy business people who might be able to get a green card, but don't really have any desperate need for it, while all of these people who are fleeing poverty or war and are in desperate need of it, you know, are disqualified. So it could be that. It could be a moment of sort of scarce resources, like a grain shortage, like these sorts of things you could imagine being reasons to ensure that citizenship would contract. And I think another explanation would be wanting to actually, this could be a sort of democratic understanding, an anti-aristocratic move. So instead of having this sort of like inbreeding, the endogamy between aristocratic or noble families from different cities, in other words, Athenians with non-Athenians, you'd be banning that. You'd be encouraging inter-Athenian marriage this way. But finally, you know, for my purposes, as I mentioned, I was really interested in the effects. So what happens with 451 alongside the kind of myth of autochthony, which is, you know, one of several ways Athenians understood who they were, you get a desire to establish the terms of sort of solidarity among Athenians of different socioeconomic backgrounds. In other words, how are we going to understand ourselves as part of a demos when we come from all of these different backgrounds, especially in terms of class, and grounding the demos or Athenian identity in an idea of blood or common descent, or, you know, common descent from a mythical ancestor, is one way to wishfully erase socioeconomic distinctions that might have been a source of conflict otherwise, or previously, you know, in an earlier time in Athenian history.
Yeah, I find that really interesting. I mean, in part why I've been asking about the causes of the change in citizenship laws is because, you know, it's almost as if it resembles in some ways the sort of development of nationalism in the modern age, which, mm-hmm. which I know a little bit more about, but just in the sense that, you know, the development of nationalism at least was an effort to create a kind of, you know, myth of about the people and its voice as a sort of dominant presence in society. And if the same thing is going on in Athens, it could be interesting that there's a sort of internal connection between the increasing democratization of Athens in the 5th century and the development of this kind of myth of the people is emerging from the earth in the autochthony myth.
Right.
I'm not sure if there's anything you think about significant about that, but at least it sounds to me, you know, it seems to me plausible that at least this sort of internal to the democratization of Athens could be a story, at least a plausible story there, of the sort of ramping up of immigration restrictions.
Yeah, absolutely. Or even, you know, to take a step back and go to something that you said, I think, right before the last point you made, there is always a question about how you're going to define the people, and that's how we would put it. But in the Athenian context, you know, the demos. And I think that one of the aims of my work in the book is to see that, or to make clear that democracy is constituted partly by this drive to draw the lines of membership, and even by nativism, and to see this as sort of, you know, I'm not making a historical argument, really. I'm not trying to say that at the second that democracy emerged, you know, you have this contraction of citizenship, but you do have an attempt to define it along kinship lines. That doesn't go away. And so the kind of romantic romantic picture of democracy as turning away from kinship or turning away from blood, and thinking that that's a kind of parochial sort of politics, I think is mistaken, and it's wishful. And I was trying to, or I am trying to show that it's not even just in times of crisis, that there, that is when, as you say, things can get amplified, and even citizens might come under fire because there's a kind of contagious suspiciousness, as we're seeing right now. But that because the rules of membership are already parasitic on a claim or a foundation in so-called nature, in times of crisis, they're going to be available for this kind of targeting or exclusion or sort of conspiratorial thinking.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, there's so much in scholarship on Greek political thought that lays out the various thinkers' critiques of democracy. And, you know, your book's great because it's a sort of a fresh, I mean, I haven't heard this account of, you know, Greek thinkers' critique of democracy in just this way. And it does indeed sort of make it very current in the sense that the sort of things you were just saying about the creation of a notion of the people and the need to draw a line between who's in and who's out is an issue that democratic theorists are still dealing with. So that's great. Yeah.
You know, I didn't say in the beginning when I said that, you know, I had all these different motivations for the book, that one thing that I was really concerned with when I started working on this book was the fact that there had actually been such excellent scholarship for decades, you know, maybe for two or three or four decades, on various forms of exclusion in Athenian democracy. And that's important to bring out because I'm not trying to say that nobody has looked at, you know, the sort of liminal or marginal figures of the classical Athenian world, but more that it's kind of interesting or telling that the Metic has dropped out of that discussion or has really not appeared at all in any kind of theoretical way. So what I mean by that is, you know, I'm sure you're somewhat familiar with the work that's been done, especially by feminist scholars on you know, gender or a place of women in Greek tragedy, also slaves and barbarians. And so all of these, this work also on Athenian citizenship that has taken into account the ways the citizen was defined against, you know, the Athenian male citizens defined against even Athenian female citizens, because they, of course, weren't citizens in sort of a full sense, or against slaves because they were free and slaves were not, or, you know, Josh Ober's important work on sort of mass and elite and thinking about class politics and the different ways that citizenship, even though it's something that the poor, Athenian poor, are newly eligible for, they're always kind of in danger of being coded as servile or uncitizenly. And so I was really interested in why it was that the Metic, which is, let's say, a third category, if you think about citizen, Metic, and slave, hadn't really featured in any of this work on, say, diversity or exclusion in Athens. It had historically, like there are a lot of, you know, historians had noted the Metic's existence, of course, for I mean, hundreds of years, but there wasn't an interest in what the Metic was as a discursive site. In other words, as a critical category or as a trope or as a representation, a figuration in texts. And so the problem with that was that the questions that the Metic raised about nativism, about blood-based exclusion, about passing, all of those seemed somehow irrelevant to Athenian thinkers who were living in a context of immigration. And that struck me, that gap between the sort of historical interest in it and the dearth of attention by critics, in both political theorists and sort of literary scholars, seemed strange to me. And I really wanted to investigate that.
Yeah, that's a great summary. And you mentioned passing, which we haven't talked about, but that's when a Metic tries to pass as a citizen, right? And it's crime.
Right.
Punishable by?
By slavery. So that's you know, kind of jumping toward the end of the book, I have a chapter on a Demosthenes speech that I actually find very moving, because it revolves around a disenfranchised citizen's appeal to his deem or to his jury to reinstate him as a citizen. They've decided to take away his citizenship because even though he lived as a quite prominent member of his deem, he served in various capacities to as a leader of his deem. In other words, his sort of political community within Athens. He was not someone of high birth. He was a ribbon seller, and his parents did these sorts of jobs in the agora. And possibly, if we believe the client, Euxithius, so it's not Demosthenes. Demosthenes wrote the speech for this guy. It might have been the case that he was disenfranchised because of political, revenge, because somebody was out to get him, his accuser Eubulides. But what I think is really interesting about this speech is that he's there appealing to the deem. If he loses the case, he's going to be enslaved. So he's lost his citizenship. He's gone from citizen to medic, and now he's at risk of enslavement. And every attempt that he makes to prove his lineage in that context, we don't know how the case actually was decided, but every attempt he makes, we can imagine sort of reading the other way, like, well, my father served, in the Peloponnesian War. Well, actually, medics, did that too. Or, we worked in the agora, and just because we're poor, that doesn't mean that we're medics. But then the problem is that medics and citizens worked side by side. So it's kind of a fascinating way into, I think, that climate and how all of the attempts that the Athenians made to actually secure citizenship for Athenians, for, we might even say, the citizen poor, can actually work against them. They can be rhetorically deployed in ways that imperil the very people that are meant to be secured by autocracy.
Right. It's almost as if there's not much difference really between the citizen and the medic. The proof is really tenuous there. I mean, I found interesting in that chapter, so the Athenians didn't appeal to any, there weren't any sort of official documents that one could appeal to, right, in order to prove. Right. This was just about, so you leave it up to the local communities to know who's a descendant, who's not.
Although, as we know, even today, written documents can be problematic too. But you're right, a lot of this was about people sort of swearing that they knew who you were, that they could vouch for you, and also telling a plausible story about, why you were who you were. And that's still the case frequently, when you have to sort of narrate, let's say as an asylum seeker, why you need asylum, and the different sort of scripts that are available to you and that will increase your chances of actually making a viable claim to safety and sanctuary.
Yeah, that's great. So let's turn to some of the text we've been talking about, Demosthenes. Let's turn to some of the other texts you talk about. So you take up Euripides' Ion, Plato's Republic, and the Demosthenes speech as windows into the way in which some Greek thinkers take a critical stance towards this category of the medic, that the medic is revealed to be in these works something of an artificial category, not something that's natural. And so I thought maybe we could start by talking about the Euripides play, Ion, to get sketch briefly, the overall story of the plot and when it was written and produced.
Mm-hmm, sure. So Euripides' Ion is a tragedy that is not widely read in political theory. And I was drawn to it, as you'll see in a second, because of what happens to the main character, Ion, because his autochthonous, his Athenian identity is really the central concern of the of the myth, you know, this discovery that he makes that he's actually Athenian and then what he does to that. But I should start by saying that the date is a bit contested. So it seems like it was probably written or at least performed around 412, I think, 411. And so that was, you know, in the middle of the Peloponnesian War and around the time of the Sicilian campaign, the Athenian campaign in Sicily, which was disastrous. And, you know, as far as Thucydides is concerned, a really important turning point in the war. And so what you also have is Athenians now around four decades into this Periclean citizenship law, but questions about identity and about their difference from other Greeks are obviously going to be very important in this period because of the fighting that's going on. And the other thing to mention that I didn't earlier, and this comes up in the tragedy, is that with the shift to dual Athenian parentage, the criterion, of course, becomes more difficult to meet, but it also makes women or mothers very important. So you can't just have a paternal Athenian line. You need a maternal one as well. And this is actually how Ion gets his Athenian-ness. He has it from his mother, Creusa. So the play opens in Delphi, and Ion is living as a kind of orphan. He's a kind of caretaker at the temple, and he finds out from Xuthos that he is Xuthos' long-lost son. Now, Xuthos is a very complicated plot, so I might not get into everything. Xuthos is Creusa's non-Athenian husband, who she's married in part as a kind of a thank you for his help in some sort of, I can't remember right now, but some sort of Athenian battle. So right there, we get a glimpse into the sort of alliances that elites or aristocratic families would create through marriage. And that might be one of the things that Autochthony was trying to disrupt. In any event, Ion is under the impression, because Xuthos is under the impression that he's found his long lost son that he, you know, fathered at some point with a woman that he doesn't really know. And he is asked to come back to Athens as his son, as a kind of medic. And Ion says, basically, I know all about Athenian autochthony, even though I would go there as a wealthy, you know, sort of socially mobile person. There are things like, you know, things like wealth and family background can never really trump the importance of blood in Athens, and I really would never be like fully integrated. I wouldn't be an Athenian. And so you see in the things that Ion says the importance that Athens places on autochthony. Of course, the irony here is that he is, it turns out, an Athenian autochthonous person. He just doesn't know that he's Creusa's son, because Creusa was raped by Apollo, bore him, gave him up, and has been living with this secret, which she hasn't told her husband. So through a series of different events, eventually Ion and Creusa have a recognition scene. But what he learns is that in order to return to Athens, this is at the end of the play, Athena tells him he has to hide the truth about his lineage, keep the secret from Xuthos, and return to Athens, where he will help, you know, Athenians sort of reproduce. In other words, he's like integral to the future of the polis over time, and then its imperial expansion in Ionia and stuff like that. Ionia, you know, from Ion. So the condition for his return to Athens, the condition for Athens to reproduce itself as autochthonous, is that this autochthonous person closet, keep secret his autochthonous identity. And so what I was interested in figuring out is why this sort of native Athenian has to pretend to be a medic. This is a kind of inversion of a typical immigration fable, where you have an immigrant passing as a citizen. What you have is a citizen passing as a medic. And, you know, it's important to keep in mind that in the a tragedy, you're going to have some things that fit with Athenian law and custom and other things that don't. And so we can't, like, you know, not everything is going to fit perfectly. Like, why would this Athenian be, why would he count as an Athenian if he's like semi-divine and he only has an Athenian mother, etc.? So we can't resolve everything perfectly, but I thought it was really curious that there's this sort of strange secret and this sort of passing at the heart of the story, and why it is that Athens requires that from its progenitor in order to actually become the democracy that is very concerned with keeping the difference between citizens and medics apparent and also politically significant.
Yeah, and of course, another irony is that this is performed in front of Athenians, right? So the secret is revealed anyway. It's a sort of interesting feature of these playwrights at that time. One of the things you point out is the sort of interesting feature of this play is that it's supposed to be a tragedy, but yet it's not clear in what way it's a tragedy because nobody really dies, right? So is the tragic element of it kind of contradictory element of the myth of autochthony that that we need to believe it as we need to believe ourselves as natural citizens, even though it's an artificial myth. Is that what you take to be the tragic element, or what is it there?
Yeah. So I mean, you're referring to the fact that we tend to think about tragedy as containing some sort of violence, and the fact that the violence is averted in this tragedy and that there's a kind of mother-son reunification, you know, it does seem like a happy tale or a romance. I take the tragic elements. I would agree with what you're saying overall. I mean, I think that there's, but I would place the emphasis more on the unsettling, the kind of resistance to resolution at the end, the kind of maybe even aporetic quality of the tragedy, the way that there is the resolution in the terms in the sense of familial reunification, but actually it ends in practice with this family pretending to be something that they're not, and with this character really, at least for the time being, not being able to actualize who he finds out he is. And so in that sense, it's unsettling and it feels kind of incomplete. What I took to be the sort of political insights or theoretical insights from all of that are that, you know, especially I liked your point about people watching this. So the kind of open secret or the revealing of Ion's secret would be that, you know, so here we have an act of masquerade at the founding of democratic Athens. And the way in which the Athenian emphasis on blood is not necessarily going to guarantee a lived experience of citizenship for those who are eligible to claim it. And yet the fact that there is this blood criterion makes the idea of passing possible. And so one of the ways I understand it in the book is that at the end of the day, you know, the focus on blood is going to make the idea of a false performance or a masquerade or a passing and anxiety about that always a political possibility that can be taken up or not, right? But the point is that this is, in that sense, the kind of, the dilemma or the conflict that is a sort of always sitting at the heart of democracy where it can be taken up.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me in a little about Nietzsche's account in The Birth of Tragedy of Greek tragedies, although he doesn't have a lot of good things to say about Euripides, but at least there's a sort of surface way in which there's a kind of, Apollinean Dionysian distinction here that there's the sort of Apollinean appearances of the structures and categories of order that remain in place, while underneath we know that it's all kind of chaos and everybody's mixed up and there's all kind of chaos there. I don't know. It just occurred to me. I don't know if that's helpful in thinking about this, but
no, I think you're right. And I think that point nicely matches up with something you said before, which is like, you know, it appears that things are resolved, but actually, even in the play, I'm saying, you know, at the level of family romance, but actually, there's something deeply unsettling about the fact that in this family, there is this deep, dark secret that she has to keep, which is that she bore a son following a rape, and that her husband can't really know who this is, because if he did, he would probably need to get rid of him. And right, so there's all this turmoil and darkness just right under the surface.
Yeah, so at least I take that at the end of the day to be something like a kind of acceptance of the necessarily self-contradictory nature of democracy, right? Yes. Not that. I mean, one way I suppose to read it is, you know, Euripides is a reformer or something like that, and he wants to try to upend the Medic system, and does this through sort of dramatizing the weirdness that's at the heart of Athens. But I suppose another way to read it is that, you know, he really does think that this is a necessary myth, and that that democracies have this kind of internally contradictory nature. So is that how you read it, or do you read it as sort of a more progressive view?
Oh, well, I think more or less. I mean, you know, I like what you're saying. I think the way I tried to understand it was, if this is a founding myth, because this is a version of the Autochthony myth, the founding story of Athenian democracy, then he's giving us sort of the myth that the Athens, his audience is sitting in, needs. In other words, the myth that's going to explain the kind of politics that they are living and practicing. In other words, it's an ideology. It's a kind of explanation for how you could get something like Medic citizen blurring. And so it's almost like, in a way, it's a kind of critical description of what's going on, but it's also giving us a way of understanding why democracy's ideals, like an ideal like autochthony, would be working itself out in practice this way. And that's because of its grounding in blood, in a context of mobility, you know, imperial expansion, class mobility. And I just liked it as a kind of, I mean, actually, you were saying something about the different texts that I'm drawing on. And one reason that I draw on this one and I draw on the Republic is that I think that they're both attempts at rewriting the Athenian myth of autochthony in ways that allow for kind of critical reflection on the tenets of democracy. And I think that the tragic version, the Euripidean version, is probably more of a look at, you know, why things are the way they are now. And I think Plato's might be up to something slightly different. It's critique, but I'd have to think about the ways that it's also obviously positing an affirmative account, the Republic, you know, of how a just society would have to look, and also that politics is, as I said earlier, always going to be sort of driven in some way by an impulse toward hierarchy.
Yeah, good. So let's talk about the Republic. Always a crowd pleaser for political theorists. So, and you spend the bulk of the book on it. You have three chapters on the Republic, one chapter on the frame of the book, which really contains a lot of the sort of famous discussion with Medics, and the second chapter on the noble lie, in quite an interesting way, and then the third chapter on the discussion of democracy in Book 8. So let's talk about the frame. It's, of course, a very famous frame, which Socrates is going down to the Piraeus and about to go to the festival of Bendis, and he's interrupted on the way, and he talks to two Medics, Cephalus and his son Polymarchus. So maybe you could start by talking a little bit about what you take to be the, maybe we can talk a little bit about who these characters are, I suppose, to start. But then what you take to the significance of the fact that these are Medics that frame the Republic.
Yeah. I think this might be my favorite chapter in the book. And I think it's because it's the place where I, I get to at least set the stage for, if not demonstrate, the importance of taking seriously the rhetorical strategies that Plato uses to construct the Republic. And what I mean by that is, you know, earlier when I said that I was perplexed by the fact that there had been all this work on Greek tragedy and interest in who the sort of marginal figures were in, let's say, Euripides or Sophocles. And then on the other hand, there'd been all this historical work on metics. That when we got to the Republic, where we get metics with the most specificity, the most sort of density in classical Greek thought, there was a real lack of interest, if not kind of active disavowal of the importance of the staging and scenography. We could use that term to think about, you know, the dramatic context, the historical allusions that are populating Plato's text. And so one reason that the metic has sort of dropped out of theoretical engagements with classical Greek thought is that we tend not to think about the literary aspects or rhetorical strategies that some of these thinkers use as sites of theoretical meaning, places where they're generating arguments. And that's especially the case with a thinker like Plato, who, as I said, you know, earlier, especially in sort of analytic philosophical discussions, but not only, even some very, you know, context-sensitive literary readers still tend to think that Plato is not using these resources in any way that's meaningful other than to say Socrates is there to flee the unsavory, you know, kind of chaotic world of Athenian democracy for the abstract, orderly space of Kallipolis. And so to the extent that people do register the sort of Piraeus metic space of the Republic, what I call the metic space, they do so to explain the kind of trajectory of the text that it basically gets out of that place. And I'm arguing that, of course, the whole narrative needs to be read as something that is contained, enabled, made possible by this home that belonged to two prominent metics, or at least one and his family, on the outskirts of Athens in the port area Piraeus from which Athenians sailed to go on their colonial expeditions, and in a place that is heavily associated with immigration, trade, the mobility of peoples and goods, and also of the kind of hierarchical relationship, we might say, that is quite unstable between Athens and its port, or Athens and its empire, and the ways in which those two things are in a kind of co-constitutive relationship to each other. So all of that I'm saying is present, and it needs to be sort of activated. And the question that I pose at the beginning of the text, to answer your question sort of why does this matter, is that, you know, it seems like the question of what justice is, or the desire to look at politics on the ground and see how it could be differently envisioned or changed. All of that, for some reason, has to take, or why is it that it has to take place in a metic's home? And what I suggest is that we kind of couldn't see Athens. We couldn't see even the Kallipolis if we didn't see it from the perspective of the metic. And there I really see him sort of dramatizing for us the way that citizenship or the citizen is defined against the metic. I think that the dramaturgy or the scenography actually brings that to life, and that a lot of the concerns with how we order people, how what we think membership is, how we draw the lines of membership that proceed have to do partly with the provocation. You know, Polemarchus is the metic who is going to be murdered years later by the tyrants, the 30 tyrants, is the catalyst. It's the metic home that makes all of this possible. And so I'm trying to kind of bring out the way the rest of the Republic might be an answer to this scene, this kind of the membership exclusion and intermixing and mingling and melding that is being depicted, not because it's a, it's Plato's, as I say later, his lament about the sort of lack of natural distinction or lack of order in Athens, but the ways in which Athenian politics is partly constituted by this kind of either this exploitation or this sort of mercenary membership that it enables in, you know, people who are disenfranchised but socially and politically visible, which would be to say that, you know, that's the Medic situation.
Right, because Socrates as a character doesn't make these kinds of distinctions, right? I mean, he's just interested in having conversations, which is interesting. And he's also interested in the festival of Bendis. So, I mean, even though Socrates famously never leaves Athens, I suppose we could talk about that, but there's a cosmopolitan character to him. But the fact that Plato puts him in dialogue with a Medic is crucial. And so that as you say, he sort of founds this Callipolis in the house of a Medic is quite telling.
Yeah. And, you know, just briefly to sort of illustrate some of what you're saying and what I was saying before, the Bendis scene, I think, is very important because it's an instance of Athenians incorporating a Thracian, which is to say a foreign goddess, into their pantheon. And the procession, I mean, people think that this was what Plato is depicting there as the sort of inaugural festival to Bendis. And the procession that he's gone to watch, to be a spectator of in the first few lines of the Republic, is characterized by two separate processions, actually, one conducted by Thracian medics and one conducted by Athenians, they're all worshippers, but they have this sort of segregated parade. And he concludes very early, really first few lines of the Republic, that he was interested in seeing how they would do it. And he concludes that they performed the procession or the ritual equally well. And I take this as another way that the text is underscoring for us right off the bat that the autochthonous distinction between Athenians and non-Athenians that's supposed to reveal itself in practice actually does not consistently, and that this is one of the first ways that the Republic is giving the lie to the myth of autochthony and sort of paving the way for or creating space for a new way of understanding what membership should be, which is not going to be ground in a sort of pre-given difference like blood, even though, of course, the myth of the metals is going to let us know that something like a pre-given difference is going to be politically useful for people to believe in.
Yeah, and we can talk a little bit about Cephalus and Polymarchus as characters. I'm not sure if you have a sort of reading on, I mean, the fact that he has two medics, not just one, Cephalus and then his son. And so there's a generational issue there. Cephalus is concerned. He's getting old and he's concerned about repaying his debts because he's going to soon meet the afterlife. And isn't really particularly much interested in conversing with Socrates. Whereas Polymarchus is more interested, and his answer is, remind me, it's about friends and enemies. Justice is giving to friends and taking from enemies.
What they deserve.
Yeah. Okay. What do you think about, you know, why Plato includes those two and what the significance of the generational difference is in portraying the medics?
Yeah, you know, I think the way I think about the differences between the two of them have to do partly with, at least this is, you know, I think there's a kind of overwhelming emphasis on this in the criticism on the Republic, that Cephalus does represent the older generation, a kind of piety, a mercantilism, however, you know, he's very concerned with wealth, and there's a sense that Polymarchus is closer to the 5th century, concern with perhaps a different kind of mobility, actually. I have to think a little bit more about, you know, why I get that sense when I'm reading book one. But Polemarchus seems much more, he's much more integrated, maybe because he doesn't leave, whereas Cephalus takes off, mm-hmm. you know, the second that the conversation gets a little bit complicated. But I tend not to think about them in terms of generational difference so much, because I'm actually more interested in how they both manifest medicness, but haven't been read that way. And so if I could just say a little bit about that, because I think it might help answer your question. You know, Cephalus is typically read as, you know, basically just a wealthy person whose lack of citizenship status doesn't bear on the text. It doesn't matter, because to go back to the Ion, you know, this is the thing Ion doesn't believe. Wealth is supposed to actually trump distinctions in membership. And I argue that actually the ways that he is featured as particularly pious or concerned with money are the two areas, religious worship and, you know, obviously labor, that medics were actually, they were free totally to not only to pursue those areas of life, but and to become very prominent, but they were, because they were barred from the sort of deliberative spaces of Athenian society, they start to model a certain way of being Athenian. So even for citizens, that I think Plato is concerned with exploring in Book 8 of the Republic, where he starts to paint a picture of democratic citizenship as actually, you know, they're just a lot of citizens who would rather not be bothered with having to participate, and they're much more concerned with a certain kind of social freedom or license to do whatever they want. And so that's concerned with, you know, also with acquiring wealth. And so I think it's important to first see how Cephalus and Polemarchus are medics before we can see how they also come to model what citizenship is in danger of becoming. And Polemarchus, I would say, is a kind of quintessential medic, partly because of what we know happened to him later. He was targeted by the 30 tyrants, and so was his brother Lysias, the famous orator, who is present at in the Republic that night but says nothing. And there are other non-citizens and slaves who are there, other citizens who are there too who say nothing. So there's people from every kind of membership category. But anyway, Polemarchus and Lysias were targeted for their wealth. And I think we get the sense of the kind of looming and arbitrary tyrannical violence, suspiciousness, but also the vulnerability that even, you know, Hannah Arendt talks about this. That the Jews thought was that because they had social equality, that political equality might not be, or legal equality might not be necessary. But we see in times of crisis, if you are not actually protected, if you don't have full legal protections, you are more vulnerable than citizens, but citizens are vulnerable too because laws change.
Yeah, I find it interesting about Polemarchus that his view of justice is, you know, a friend-enemy distinction, which of course, again, summons right. up Schmidt and so contemporary yeah. democratic theory that sort of reflects what you're doing here. But it is interesting, you know, that particularly is his view coming from a vulnerable medic. And, you know, it is a sort of, you know, psychology there that is very, very vulnerability leads him to take these sort of strong, sharp distinctions that then, you know, become his own undoing if he himself is not a friend, revealed not to be a friend of the Athenian regime, and his wealth can be plundered and so forth. So, yeah, I just wonder if, you know, if there's something built into his own account of justice that's sort of telling there.
You know, that's such a great point, actually, because it both brings me back to something in the book and also makes me think about things that that aren't in the book that could have been. And so when you say that he's concerned with the friend-enemy distinction in relationship to justice, it's true that, you know, there's this really interesting moment where, because he stays quiet really for almost all of the dialogue, you know, and that's one reason that people conclude that, well, the medics they're not really very important in this text. He does something at the beginning of book five, I think, is where it happens. It's he whispers in the ear of Adeimantus or Glaucon, and that is what returns that interruption, we never actually hear from him. And at, like a good medic, he has a citizen who speaks for him, because medics, of course, were not allowed to speak publicly, in any kind of deliberative spaces. So even though this is an informal, a private home, there's a way in which it's kind of miming that that relationship. But anyway, he whispers, and that's actually what gets the conversation back onto the subject of kinship, really, of having children and you might say wives in common. And I think that there's definitely a line that we could draw between his concern in book one and that, and then what happened, what we know to have happened to him later, which is, who counts and under what, according to what criteria are you actually kin? Are you a friend? And the fact that he and his brother Lysias were on behalf of Athens, they colonized, they helped establish a colony, Thurii, in Sicily, at Pericles' invitation, decades before the Republic seems to be taking place, and then were expelled after the sort of the disaster of the Athenian expedition in the Peloponnesian War, despite their Sicilian origins, and had to return to Athens. You see how these distinctions between sort of who's in and who's out and who counts as kin, they're shifting. And I think, to go back to what I said before, it's not that citizens are actually inviolable. The citizen-medic line is inviolable, because if medics are vulnerable, then that means, whatever it is that's keeping a citizen is also, at least, maybe it would be the last straw, but they're going to be susceptible to a similar kind of disenfranchisement, depending on the kind of political climate.
So the noble lie, one of the most well-known parts of the Republic, the noble lie as in Socrates' view, necessary in order to bind the community together as a community and to distinguish the different classes from one another, and reflects, as you say, the myth of autochthony that's very much present in Athenian life at the time. And so you take the noble lie passage as an indication, let me see if I got this right, that it's about Plato's worry about the artificiality of political membership, right? That I mean, it's sort of a little bit like the Ion, in the sense that there's a sort of necessary myth at the heart of all political order. As you say in the book, it's an open secret, right? That Plato is making bare the artificiality of and the mythness of autochthony. Is that right?
Yeah. So the one thing I would quarrel with a little is that it's a worry. I don't think it's a worry. I think as you went on to say, it's a laying bare of what we kind of all know is true, which is that, the distinction between citizens and non-citizens, even though it's said to be based in some sort of natural fact, is really a political artifice, and that's something that he's showing, but that is so taboo that it can kind of only be obliquely addressed. And so I take the Republic as arguing that all of these sorts of naturalized distinctions are the effect of sort of the quotidian work of politics, sort of the everyday practices of policing, or even just like the institutions or laws that create these distinctions. That he's putting he's underscoring this in a way that is very interesting, because he's doing it in a medic's home. And so what the chapter tries to do is say, there is no duping going on here. We're not being deceived. This is not some sort of endorsement of lying in politics exactly. I mean, it's telling us that it's going to be, as you said before, basically politically necessary or efficient to get people to stay invested in their place in society. In other words, if what you want is to have hierarchy, which even in Athens you have, right? You have the demos, then you have everybody else. Then you are going to need to make sure people believe that their was no chance for them to be in any other, you know, class in society. So it's more like what Athens gets wrong is that it doesn't structure society in such a way as to keep the truth about the artifice of natural distinctions secret. It actually, as we saw in the Festival of Bendis, makes it apparent all the time. And yet that doesn't actually make something like autochthony or political difference inefficacious. It's still going to have a hold. It's still going to be something that you can mobilize. And so I think that he's showing us both, that you have this myth that kind of undermines itself in practice, and yet it still has a grip on reality. And so what you then have is a kind of politics of passing and suspicion, because you can't you're not going to get rid of it, but then you're also always aware of the way in which the ways in which it's revealing itself as an artifice.
Yeah, it's clearly meant to be a kind of fantastical moment. I mean, this is in part why, I mean, this is one of the places where Leo Strauss talks about how, you know, it's an indication of, you know, that this isn't really meant to be taken seriously as a kind of utopian society, but rather a kind of indication of the limits of nature and self-contradictions that are characteristic of the natural world to make it impossible to make anything perfect. But in any case, I mean, the one thing I would say, though, is that, you know, Socrates does refer to it as a noble lie, right? So, so in some way, there is an indication that this, you know, it's something that's good, right? Or no?
Yeah, I mean, so that's a really interesting question. I mean, so you're referring to the fact that it's a ganaion pseudos, a noble lie, or at least we translate ganaion as noble. So the question is, in what sense is it good? I think it's good because the noble lie will help the Kallipolis avoid degeneration over time. So if the aim of a political founding or rule is to maintain stability and order, which I think is very clear in the Republic, that what you want to avoid is civil strife and a kind of the erosion of institutions, then you're going to need to come up with a myth that will keep people doing what they're supposed to do. And so it's a good lie in the sense that it serves the regime well, whereas, I don't know, one could argue that maybe the Athenian, as I'm saying this, I'm not so sure. I was going to say the Athenian lie doesn't serve the polis, but maybe it does, you know, because it is like the promise of the medic passing as a citizen that is part of the allure of being in Athens. And so that's one sense in which it's ganaion. It's kind of it's useful. It's salutary. But then there's another way. I think there's another, you know, kind of meaning of it in Greek, which is it's kind of being true to your descent. So we could read it that way too, or your birth.
Mm. Oh, right. The genos part. Okay. I didn't get that. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. Okay. That's good. Yeah. I mean, I think that maybe this is the time to bring it up. I mean, one of the broader theses of your book is that I think part of what you're trying to do, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the sort of challenge, the sort of aristocratic, or I think maybe some points you put elitist reading of Plato and some of these others, that at some of these moments they sort of reveal that they're more egalitarian than others. Is that a fair way to put the point? I mean, you feel free to elaborate on that if you want. Yeah.
Right. Okay. I would tweak that to say that what I mean when I say that I think the book is complicating the tendency in criticism to see Athenian thinkers like Plato as part of an elite tradition is that I'm saying, okay, it is an elite tradition of writing insofar as who they were and were they aristocratic, etc. But what I'm taking issue with is that they weren't just concerned with what they took to be the kind of problem of the empowerment of the masses. In other words, okay, they might have been elite thinkers, but they're not just concerned with class, and they're not just concerned with the way that democratic citizenship means the empowerment of the poor. They are concerned with that, but they're simultaneously concerned with the way that democracy has to define the citizenry as blood-based. And so in other words, we have to see that while citizenship is expanding and Athens is wishfully sort of eroding barriers to membership for the poor, it's also generating and leaning on a logic and language of what I call blood to give citizenship its boundaries. And so it's really more of a critique of not of you know the fact that they're concerned with the poor, but it's that there's also a concern with nativism and how nativism is sort of part of this shift toward equality and participation.
That's helpful. Yeah, I mean, because one other thing, I mean, I think there are some readings of Plato that seek to think that all the kind of categorizations that human beings make are artificial and that there's no natural rank order. But it strikes me that Plato is worried about the sort of distortions of the natural sort of order of things. And a democracy is one such distortion, right? I mean, this maybe gets us into the democracy discussion, so we can sort of transition into that. But yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I mean, I read Plato as a thinker that is interested in the political meanings that we assign to differences. In other words, sure, there's going to be anatomical difference. There's age difference. There's difference in status in the sense of like, you know, like, teachers and students or something like that, and in roles and occupations, there's differences between human beings and animals. But I guess the question is what kind of meaning we want to vest these distinctions with. And so I think they're going to be for the Republic, some regimes that do a worse or better job of not only vesting, I mean, I think every kind of regime vests its distinctions with political meaning, but I take Plato as interested in whether these are going to fall apart and whether these are, or what sorts of interests they serve ultimately. And I think in the Book 8 passage that you're referring to that I talk about in Chapter 5, that's typically read as a description of democracy is kind of undoing its own, well, actually not undoing really its own distinctions, but as having a kind of allergy to distinction, that, you know, that democracy doesn't care about the natural differences between people. And by that, people, critics seem to mean, you know, differences in anatomy or sex and gender, differences in between citizens and slaves, these sorts of things. And so that passage has been read in democratic theory as Plato's like inadvertent, it's not an inadvertent insight, but it's one that he's not happy about, that democracy is kind of rebellious. It is always going to throw off these sorts of categories. People don't want to be contained by these distinctions, and that he's very upset about this, you know, that what he wants is to sort of reinstate order. And the reading that I offer of that is different, because what I'm saying there is that he's not actually invested in any of these democratic or Athenian statuses or distinctions. He's actually showing us how even in democracy, you know, a democracy is invested in actually categories of difference that in practice reveal themselves to be not natural, but actually, you know, artifices like the ones that we see in the Noble Lie, and that people act a lot like each other because these, say, differences in blood or sex do not actually determine conduct. They don't determine performance. And so what I find in the Republic is more of an exploration of the kind of performative character of these distinctions, these membership distinctions, rather than a kind of romantic picture of democracy that is just, you know, as I said earlier, allergic to distinctions of all kind. It's that they have distinctions and they reveal themselves in practice, in Plato's view, as not living up to what they claim, what they guarantee, which is that, you know, pre-given difference is going to determine conduct, determine practice.
Yeah, that's helpful. I mean, let me see if I have this right. I mean, it seems like the idea is something like Plato's offering an, may call it, imminent critique of democracy in Book 8. That is that, you know, when one may look around at an existing Athenian democracy in the 5th century, and that democracy makes all sorts of distinctions that it passes off as natural, like the distinction between citizen and medic, for instance. But really, the tendency of democracy is towards the sort of destruction of those distinctions, or at least the sort of undermining of them, right? So it's you know, so in other words, democracy isn't stable in that sense, that it tends towards its own undoing. Do I have that right?
Yeah. So okay. So I totally agree that he's an imminent critic of democracy. I really like the way you characterized the reading of Book 8 as such, as an imminent critique. I actually think that what democracy does is show us more easily how all distinctions actually are going to sort of occasionally reveal themselves in practice as not natural. All natural ones are going to reveal themselves in practice as artificial. And if you think about what he's up to in the Noble Lie sections, the Kallipolis, the job of the philosopher rulers is really one of the jobs going to be to make it, you know, not fall apart, right? To make these distinctions not visible to, not the distinctions, but the precarity or the fragility of these distinctions. He wants to make sure that that is not known, that that's not visible. And I think democracy just does a really good job of showing us that, partly because of the kind of mobility that's possible, just even in terms of like the spaces that people are occupying together. You know, the fact that like in the building of the Parthenon, medics and citizens and slaves were working together. There are these really amazing, there's archaeological evidence that shows how much they were paid, and that lists all the workers, you know, and you really get a sense of how blended everybody was.
Yeah, that's great. I'm looking at the time now, and I see this has been a great conversation. Time's just passed by. So, I mean, there's so much other great stuff that you talk about in these chapters. I particularly enjoyed the discussion, the pairing of Pericles' funeral oration and then the Plato's Menexenus, in which Aspasia appears as a famous female medic in this dialogue, who happens to be Pericles and Socrates' teacher. Maybe just briefly, if you want to say a little bit about the Menexenus and Pericles' funeral. I mean, this is now, I'm asking you to summarize like 20 pages of your book, but I found it to be really useful. If you want to say a bit about that, and we can turn to the conclusion and the contemporary significance of this.
Yeah, I'll try to be really brief, because Menexenus is, maybe I won't summarize it, but basically the Menexenus postscript to chapter 5 kind of takes up what I'm arguing in a sense in reading the Republic as a medic space, which is that there's something about the characterization that is delivering a political insight. So in other words, Plato is, his characters are enacting a point about how citizenship is defined in the following sense. Menexenus has Socrates sort of, he pretends to be Aspasia. He takes on her voice to deliver a send-up, really, of a funeral oration, and claims that she was his teacher. She taught him and taught Pericles, and she, of course, was a medic and Pericles' longtime companion, and she had a child with him, and she was a great teacher, a kind of a philosopher in her own right, or at least rhetorician. And the funeral oration itself is pretty terrible. I mean, it makes lots of just kind of over the top statements about Athenian greatness. And I was interested in what it meant to have Socrates imitate a Medic woman. And in the end, what I argue very succinctly is that you kind of can't understand Athenian autochthony, which is the really huge theme of the speech. In contrast to the Periclean funeral oration we get in Thucydides, where autochthony is not really mentioned, but is sort of there under the surface, in this version, autochthony is front and center, and there's a way in which, you know, we can't understand what a citizen is unless we understand what an autochthonous citizen is against the Medic woman, because Athenian male citizens are defined against both women and Medics ultimately, because Medics were free but disenfranchised by blood. So it's that blood and gender distinction that helps to give citizenship its meaning that I think is getting performed or getting enacted by the structure of the text.
Yeah, great. That was a great quick summary. Let's fast forward thousands of years to...
I mean, I didn't bring up mimesis, which is kind of strange, because this is, of course, what is in lots of the chapters, is that kind of imitation. But that is what's happening, is there's a mimetic operation there. Sorry to cut you off, okay. But I think it's important to just bring out that's what's in Pericles' funeral oration, is this kind of desire for non-citizens to emulate, to imitate citizens. And then in Plato, we get the kind of darker, the kind of underside of that, which is like, well, yeah, Athenians do need Medics to imitate them, but sometimes you can't really tell the difference, and that actually gives the lie to the Athenian citizen as this kind of inviolable category, you know, because it does become difficult to tell the difference. And so you sort of open the door to that possibility when you have the kind of desire for emulation and immigration that Pericles is talking about.
So I found the book to be so exciting and being so timely. I think you must have completed the book after, you know, Trump had this discussion about birthright citizenship, and he doesn't, you know, he need not abide by birthright citizenship clause in the 14th Amendment. And but you know, it's just like a lot of the discussion that we've been having over the past couple of years about immigration, and it's, I think, directly bears on your discussion. So maybe you want to say a little bit about what, you know, what you take to be, you know, how you think the wisdom of these ancient thinkers that you're talking about can be applied to the present day.
Yeah, you know, I think that I actually sent the final draft. I mean, I had another shot at it, but I think I sent the final draft back on election day.
Okay.
And it just took a while.
Wow. You were
but that was crazy.
Yeah. Prescience, for sure.
Yeah, and just what feels like the different world that we're living in. Of course, all these issues were just as pressing then, I think some of the issues around birthright citizenship only became apparent a couple months later. But, you know, I think that one of the things I was trying to do with this book was mobilize the Medic as a critical category. And so, in the conclusion of the book, I really ask, and here I turn to Nietzsche, you know, what it is about the Greeks that not only we've like kind of strategically forgotten so as to kind of keep an investment in a sort of romantic idea of Athens going, but also how we can use the Greeks to estrange ourselves, or to think critically about and in new ways about the ways we think today. So I turn there to Castoriadis and the idea that we can see Athens or the Medic as a germ, as something that's also that we're going to think with, but that's also going to trouble some of our contemporary modes or angles of vision. And from there, I really thought, you know, the thing that's really interesting about the Medic is its resistance to easy translation. into the contemporary. And so because as we started off in the conversation, you know, I said, well, the medic is both a foreigner and the child of a foreigner. And so I thought, well, we like to think of these distinctions as really discrete, native, foreigner, you know, legal, illegal immigrant. Is there something about the medic that actually troubles all of these sort of neat oppositions? And one of the things that I wanted to bring out in the book was the way that kind of intergenerational exclusion, even if we don't have a term like the medic to capture those things, still persists, and it goes under, you know, the name of something else like racism or second class citizenship. But that it might be important to think that the kind of the medic has always been with us, and that we just lack a critical concept for naming these, for in other words, for grouping together all of these sort of operations, and also for seeing how these sorts of exclusionary tactics mutate over time. And so, you know, in the book, I look at how sometimes it might be a difference in wealth, sometimes it might be a difference in blood, but there are these attempts to find a language or a logic of exclusion. And in the contemporary case, it might be something like crossing a border illegally, right? So the tendency to think that geographical and ascriptive borders are totally distinct, I think starts to kind of, that idea starts to look a little bit fishy when we consider the medic. So I'll try to make my point a little clearer. The recent, especially I think it was like late October, early November, when Trump was talking about birthright citizenship and the possibility of taking birthright citizenship away from children who were born in this country, in the U.S., to undocumented immigrants or people who had come into the country illegally. That was a great moment for thinking about the medic, because what we were really talking about there is how you could inherit illegality. And so we like to think about, you know, in this country that birth trumps blood. In other words, birth in the territory trumps descent. But actually, here's one of those cases where the two are kind of coming together. And in a way, you know, blood is trumping birth by recourse to some sort of illegal movement or malignant mobility in a territory. And for me, the medic is pointing to a blood-based distinction, helps us to see how illegality can start to be treated as a kind of mark of character, something that is like essentially true about a person that can be passed down, or if you're a lawbreaker once, you're a lawbreaker as such. So I was really trying to bring out the different ways that the medic can help us see these as recurring problems or enduring dilemmas in democratic life, and that they were there at the so-called origins, not only of democracy, but importantly of political theory. And that we do ourselves a disservice when we think that a concern with political kinship or blood is something that only late modern thinkers have been concerned with. And we sort of read that issue out of, you know, what is considered the foundational text of political theory, Plato's Republic. Because I think what the Republic shows us, and what I'm trying to get at in the conclusion of the book, is how this kind of immigrant exclusion or natural difference is a recurring question for political life. And a lot of political theory tries to resolve it by making prescriptions, and that's important work. But I think the critical tradition that we can recover from the Greeks is one that treats it as an aporia, an endless sort of aporia for political life, so that we don't just think, oh, once the law has solved this problem for this population, we're fine. Because not only do laws change, but laws are actually involved in defining what we take to be kinship, which of course is something that we take to be natural.
Good. Yeah. Well, ending on aporia is very appropriate Socratic way to end. So let me say, you know, Dimi, thank you so much. This was such a fabulous conversation and so much fun. So thanks again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
That was wonderful. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. And thanks to you for listening.